It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For women, a trip to the doctor may come with some extra worries that they might not be taken seriously by a healthcare provider, that a physical symptom might be dismissed as psychosomatic, as all in her head. Our next guest is a doctor. In her new book, she says the development of modern medicine was, in a lot of ways, built on wrong ideas about women and their bodies. Sometimes really weird ideas about women and their bodies that still have an impact to this day. She says that having a better knowledge of this history can help women to ask better questions and be stronger advocates for their care and help providers deliver better care. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman, what level of care do you feel like you get in hospital or clinic settings? Do you feel listened to? Do you apologize for bringing things up in that doctor's office? Do you feel confident, empowered to talk about what's going on with your body? And if you are a medical care provider, think back to your training. Do you think it prepared you to deal with men and women more or less equally? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Elizabeth Coleman is a clinician and physician scientist who works as a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, specializing in breast cancer. She is an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and her new book is called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Dr. Coleman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we start digging into that history, can you talk a little bit about what you see as a provider of healthcare to women and as a woman who's needed healthcare yourself in medicine today that made you want to dig into that history?
Absolutely. So as you said, I'm a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer. I've cared for thousands and thousands of women over the course of my career. And in that, really been privy to just how many countless women have told me stories of feeling dismissed, misunderstood, invalidated for their pain, and in some instances, misdiagnosed or not diagnosed. And it's heartbreaking. And also, you know, I'm talking to you as a doctor, but of course, I've been a patient myself and had those similar sorts of experiences and cared for women in my family where it just was absolutely impossible to try to find the care that they deserved and needed. And my supreme hope is that this book is part of a greater mission to improve the health of women across the country.
And big picture, as you look at the rise of modern medicine, the 1800s into the 1900s, I think, yeah, in particular, can you talk about, I guess, the atmosphere that the people who were developing our modern medicine were living in and where it started to steer them in weird directions when it came to women?
Absolutely. Well, we know that medicine and the experience of illness is not just about the biology of disease, but is inextricably linked to history and culture and religion. And of course, throughout history, there's never really been a Western medical philosophy that elevated women's bodies or their brains for that matter as powerful and as worthy of that as men. And that really, in those themes really infused the rise of medicine at the turn of the 19th century. One of the things that we know is that medicine became more scientific, more codified. You had the rise of more rigorous standards in medical schools. But as you had this rise of the scientific revolution and germ theory and medical schools, women were increasingly sidelined from that knowledge. Historically, you may have women taking care of other women or women as the caregivers in their family, or even women as midwives. But as medicine became more specialized and scientific, women were, as a part of that sideline, they weren't allowed into medical school. And so all of these fields of medicine that became hyper-specialized, like cardiology and gastroenterology and neurology, were really developed by men, with many of the patients being women. And that inequity really played out in terms of how women were treated, what was studied, and also what continues to be funded to this day in terms of what we care about with respect to women's health.
One thing that really struck me as a powerful visual metaphor is the skeletons of women and men. Yeah. Some of the early illustrations used in medical references, when they have an image of a woman's skeleton, they would exaggerate the size of the pelvis and shrink the skull a little bit, you know, anatomically, yeah, unlikely. This means something, I think. Talk about that a little.
Right. I you know, one of the things that was so really eye-opening, literally, when I was doing the research of this book is the imagery of women. So even in during my medical training, when I learned about the female body or the skeleton for that matter, anatomical textbooks were really skewed towards visualizing the male form. And anytime I saw women's bodies, it was with respect to a reproductive function. So if I were learning about the skeleton, it would be the skeleton of a male form, or the heart, it was the heart in a male form, or the lungs in a male form. And when you go back in time and you look at the depiction of female skeletons versus male skeletons, it's infused again with ideas about what is women's function and what are they capable of. So whether the skulls were smaller or the hips were exaggerated, that related to how men saw women's bodies literally and figuratively as members of society and what was of value for their bodies.
Talking to Dr. Elizabeth Komen about her new book, All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you have an experience from the doctor's office to share. 800-642-1234. Dr. Komen, you mentioned the heart, and that was another amazing thing. One of the founders, it sounds like, of our modern way of thinking about the human heart and treating it and heart attacks and more in medicine. Dismissed the idea that women really had heart attacks. Tell us that story, please.
So Sir William Osler was one of the most important founding fathers of medicine as we know it today. He practiced at Johns Hopkins and helped develop the residency system and the training, the rigorous training that medical students go through to this day. And he was always so revered, and he deserves to be revered in many ways. But when I went back to look at, well, what did this founding father say about women and heart disease? It was really quite shocking. Case after case of his original records basically referred to women as having heart or chest pain as hysterical angina, and angina being the word for chest pain. But when he talked about men, well, this was incredibly serious, and particularly the white male with white hair working really hard at his job was at high risk for, that was the classic person that you imagine having a heart attack. And if you think about, even in popular culture, this is who we imagine, you know, the man hard at work in the office, clutching his chest, sweating, having a heart attack. And throughout my medical training, and to this day, when we think about women's heart disease, which is the number one killer of women, most doctors through their training learned that the way that women present with heart disease and a heart attack is atypical. But why would our symptoms be viewed as atypical when we're greater than 50% of the population and it's the number one killer of women? So the language of how these founding fathers refer to women's hearts and other diseases for that matter still plays out in this insidious way when we show up at the doctor's office or don't. Women are more likely to call an ambulance on their husband having a heart attack than recognize and know to call an ambulance on themselves. That absolutely needs to change, and that legacy needs to evolve to a more equitable place in our healthcare system.
And that particular doctor also points toward the title of your book, All in Her Head. Whether we're talking about heart problems or the list goes on and on, this idea that a woman's reported physical symptoms are psychosomatic. Talk a little bit, please, about the origins of that and why it became such a big thing.
Well, if you look at the word hysterical and hysteria, that comes from the Greek word for womb. And early on, we know that Greek physicians would refer to the wandering womb as being the source of women's ills. This one organ was just wreaking havoc throughout women's body. And throughout history, even though we obviously learned that the womb doesn't wander, this idea that something about women made them crazy was pervasive, whether it was our ovaries, whether it was the clitoris, whether it was the discovery of estrogen, and my goodness, we're bathing in something that just makes us head to toe completely nuts. Throughout history, you see this specter of the hysterical woman playing out, whether it's in ancient Greeks, whether it's the ancient, you know, anxious housewife being given way too much Valium in the 1970s, or even today, the way we may be overprescribing antidepressants to women who have menopause, who may have symptoms that we could use other medications for other than just throwing antidepressants at it.
And you give an example of a patient who's diagnosed, I think it's with anxiety. Turns out she's had Epstein-Barr, the virus that causes mono, causing the problems for years. This hasn't gone away. Sometimes we just are quick to throw that anxiety label now on women, which may be real, but it might hide something else more treatable.
Well, of course, anxiety is a vicious cycle. If you feel like you have something intuitively medically wrong with you and you're told consistently that you're just anxious, well, you're going to become more and more anxious because you feel like something's wrong. You feel like nothing's being addressed. So of course, many of these women were anxious. The story that you're talking about was a well-known journalist who spoke to me about, you know, she had been in war settings and war zones and really didn't suffer from anxiety. In fact, she had had a history of a cancer diagnosis and knew, you know, I know when I'm anxious, I know when I'm stressed out. And she developed Bell's palsy. She had several other neurologic symptoms and went to many different neurologists who said, I think that this is really quote unquote all in your head and you're just anxious. Ultimately, she finally found a different neurologist who validated, you know what, something's really wrong here. You have a reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus. She was given antiretrovirals, which treated that and ultimately got better. But for this woman who had been in such high stress situations and anxiety provoking situations to have to repeat over and over again, I am not anxious. This is not all in my head. Something is wrong and you need to help me is a constant refrain I hear from so many women, which is why when I say, oh, the title of my book is all in her head, there's almost this collective sigh and women want to share their story of what has happened to them when they were dismissed, when they were told they were just anxious, when something happened to be actually really medically wrong above and beyond anxiety.
We're talking to Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Her new book is called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about her book, her look back at the history of medicine? If you are a woman working who has worked in the medical field, what was your experience like? Do you have experiences as a patient you'd like to share with us, you're willing to share with us? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Her new book is called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sierra is with us in Wautoma. Sierra, hello.
Hi there. I am a current nurse practitioner student, and so in my clinical rotations, I've seen a few things, two things mainly. First is that women are mainly the caregivers that we look out to for, you know, they're the ones that convince their husbands to come in. They're the ones who should know their medical, their medication treatments and procedures and wound care and that kind of stuff, where they're the ones we usually spend the most time educating on. And then second, I actually had a patient who was going to the, an elderly patient who was going to the ER for chest pain. And eventually her primary care provider diagnosed her with anxiety, but put her on a 30-day heart monitor as well, just to see if there's anything else that had been going on. Come to find out, she had third-degree heart block and needed a pacemaker, like, immediately. So I thought that was interesting to share as well.
Sierra, thanks for sharing those experiences. Couple interesting points there. Dr. Coleman, what strikes you?
Thank you so much for sharing. And unfortunately, your stories are all too common. With respect to women being the caregivers of society, this is absolutely true on every front. And what is particularly compounded by this reality and truly heartbreaking is, who cares for women when they get sick? What happens when we realize that women are two times more likely, for example, to have Alzheimer's disease than men? And when you have diseases of the aging woman, who cares for those women? I remember there were several different doctors during my career that said, oh, you know, I wish I had a daughter like you. I only have sons. So, you know, you really need a doctor who's a female in the family or someone who's a healthcare provider that's a female to really make sure you're going to be cared for. And that's just simply unacceptable. We need to make sure that every member of society both feels cared for and capable of caring for the next person. And historically, and to this day, that burden lies with women, which makes it even harder for them to access their own care. I can't tell you how many women will never miss a dentist appointment for their children or a checkup or checking in on their husband to make sure that they go to their doctor's appointment for their shoulder pain, but then come to me and say, you know, I just didn't have time to get my mammogram. I didn't have the time. And that's simply heartbreaking. With respect to the second point, absolutely, women and heart disease and chest pain is all too commonly dismissed as anxiety. One of the things that I learned in researching for this book is that the EKG was really developed on the male form and not women, and that the EKG is a snapshot in time of the electrical activity of the heart, but can also vary with respect to a woman's hormonal status and her menstrual cycle. I take care of women all day, every day, and I did not know that fact. So we are clearly missing the boat about key points about women's roles in society, but also their medical concerns across the board, head to toe.
Sierra, thanks for the call. Janet is with us now in Eau Claire. Janet, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Janet?
Well, it's an odd subject in some ways, but at 60 years old, I was put on Ritalin because they finally diagnosed me with ADHD. And that has become more and more prevalent in the last 3 years. On a lot of social media, et cetera, but people just refuse to believe that women or girls have ADHD, and that's been going on for way too long. And the impact it has on our lives long-term is terrible. And I was diagnosed for everything under the sun, anxiety, depression, tried on different treatments, without ever thinking that I might have ADHD. So that is, I think, a really big women's health problem at this point.
Interesting, Janet. Well, I hope that diagnosis and treatment helps you. Dr. Coleman, do we think of conditions like ADHD as for boys or maybe men?
Janet, I'm so sorry for your suffering, and thank you for your willingness to share on the call today. That takes a lot of vulnerability, I know. And in writing All in Her Head, I can tell you that so much I couldn't include in the book, but every chapter I felt could be its own book. And in the nervous system chapter, this is something that I heard from countless psychiatrists, that we are missing the diagnosis of ADHD because of how we classically expect certain symptoms to present, and they may present differently in men versus women. But across the board, I heard that many times, that women being diagnosed with anxiety or depression when really they had ADHD. And these labels and how in turn we care for women become incredibly important. The language of how we listen to women instead of just imposing what we think is wrong with them, but really taking the time to listen. And one of the things that's really problematic with our healthcare system today, and you know, this is beyond which I can certainly fix as one person, is the ecosystem with how we care for patients is often very rushed. We are more beholden to electronic medical record and clicking diagnosis codes because of external pressures or third-party players like insurance companies. And we don't have the time that we really want to spend with patients to listen to what's going on, to really understand what they may be going through so that we can treat them effectively. But Janet, I'm sorry, your story is all too common, and I'm glad that you have the help that you finally need at this point in your life.
Definitely. Thanks again for calling, Janet. Dr. Elizabeth Coleman is with us, talking about her new book, All in Her Head. Back to your calls now. Catherine joins us from Waukesha. Catherine, what story did you want to share?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. So the good news of this story is that I'm now in my 70s and am very healthy and active. But when I was 45, I kept experiencing an odd pain by my left shoulder blade. And I had reported it to my female primary care physician, who kept telling me I was anxious, even though I have never been treated for or diagnosed with anxiety. So one day I am walking across the parking lot going into work, and I developed a burning sensation in the center of my chest. And I did end up going to the emergency department. I work in healthcare. I'm a psychologist, oddly enough. And I was fortunate enough to encounter a cardiologist who examined me and listened to my symptoms. And when they did an angiogram, my left main coronary artery was 95% occluded.
Wow. Catherine, I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. I'm glad you're still with us 30 plus years later. Dr. Coleman, again, Catherine's story, probably she's not the only one out there.
She's definitely not the only one. And my God, I'm so glad that you were ultimately examined and got the right care by a cardiologist. One thing I want to point out is you said you were seen by a female physician. I think one really important point about my book and this greater mission is that this is not about a war between men versus women as providers. This is about really honoring how everybody, man and women, can care for women better. We know that we need a diversity of spirit of the way that we care for women. Historically, women, and we know to this day, spend more time listening to patients, maybe seen as the mom consult where we're more empathic. There's absolutely no reason why male physicians cannot model what we know women may do better in some instances. It has to do with what we value in our healthcare system. Some of the most incredible providers that I work with are men. And certainly this isn't necessarily about the sex you were born with, but how we value some of these more historically seen as feminine traits in both men and women and offer that care to everybody equitably.
Catherine, thanks a lot for that call. And in just our last few moments, Dr. Coleman, are we doing better?
I think we are doing better. I think that, you know, if you look at the White House right now, there's the Women's Health Initiative to improve the kind of funding that we spend. You're having me on this show, which means that there is value to this conversation. I think there's a growing groundswell where women are advocating for themselves and saying, I need to be heard. There's lots of reason to have hope. And I'm so grateful for your audience today and their participation and for our shared collective drive to improve the healthcare of everybody.
Dr. Coleman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We've been talking about her new book. It's called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Remember, you could share these conversations online at WPR.org or go back and listen to archive conversations as well. Again, find all that great WPR content online at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Getting into arguments with your partner doesn't mean your relationship is doomed to fail. In fact, if we do it right, conflict can actually strengthen our relationships. Our next guests are PhD clinical psychologists and relationship therapists, and in their new book, they dig into the right and wrong ways to fight with our significant other. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you and your significant other ever fight? Do you avoid conflict at all costs? Have you received any valuable relationship advice about relationship conflict that you'd like to share? Do you have questions about how to navigate conflict in relationships? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Schwartz-Gottman is co-founder and president of the Gottman Institute. She's the lead author of the new book, Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
And John Gottman is co-founder of the Gottman Institute, co-author of Fight Right, and an alumnus of UW-Madison. John, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
Now, Julie,
really enjoyed. Yeah.
Julie, I think sometimes we think of, you know, an argument in a relationship as an inherently negative sign, but you really make the case in the book that's not true. Why is that?
Well, here's why. You know, a lot of people think, first of all, that anger is a bad thing, which it is not. In our research, what we really saw was the way that people express their anger makes all the difference. What we also saw in our research of 3,000 couples following them for as long as 20 years is that the successful couples who had long-lasting relationships did fight. They did have conflicts, but they used those conflicts as a way to really unearth something very important to their partner, and they also got to express what was really important to them. They did the conflicts in a really different way than the unsuccessful couples who ended up splitting up or staying unhappy in the relationship. So our research showed us that if conflicts are done right, thus Fight Right is the title, we really can use those conflicts as a royal road to understanding our partners.
And John, before we get into those lessons, I want to talk a little more about the research that you've been doing, as Julie just mentioned, for decades now. You two aren't just winging it here. Can you talk about how you have researched and watched couples as they talk about contentious issues to try to draw the conclusions you get to in the book?
Yeah, Rob, about 52 years ago, my colleague Robert Levinson and I designed a lab that synchronized the video time code. We filmed two people talking about an issue, talking about how their day went or a positive topic. And Julie and I designed an apartment lab where newlyweds lived for 24 hours, and we filmed them while they were awake. And in these labs, we really not only videotaped them, but we also synchronized that to the physiology that was going on, their heart rate, their blood velocity, their respiration, how much they were sweating and moving around, all these measures together. And then we had couples rate how they felt after each conversation. So they would watch the video again and turn this dial that went from very negative to very positive. And in the beginning, we just sent them home. We didn't know how to help anybody. But we tried to get representative samples in the places that we worked and followed them for a long period of time. But in the past 26 years, Julie and I have used our ability to predict the future of a relationship with over 90% accuracy, used that information to really help couples and tested our interventions. And so they really do work.
Julie, I want to get into one of the biggest mistakes, or how, let's call them four of the biggest mistakes. You talk about people in that moment of an argument in a relationship falling prey to the four horsemen of bad fighting. What are they?
Yes, we call them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, doom and disaster. So here's what they are. The first one is criticism, and that shows up particularly when bringing up an issue, but can occur anytime during the fight. And criticism means blaming a problem on a personality flaw of your partner. For example, saying something like, "You're just too lazy to clean up the kitchen." You know, there's the blaming and criticism. The second horseman is contempt, and contempt is the worst of all of them. It's like sulfuric acid on a relationship. Similar to criticism, again, it's pointing out a flaw of the partner, but doing so from a position on high, very superior. So cutting sarcasm is an example, calling your partner bad names or mocking your partner. All of those are expressions of contempt. You wouldn't even think of getting your hands wet to clean the kitchen, would you? You know, there's contempt for you, right? And contempt not only predicts the demise of a relationship, it also predicts the demise of the listener's immune system. We saw that the number of times a person heard contempt from their partner in 15 minutes predicted how many infectious illnesses they would have in the next four
Wow.
years. Isn't that incredible? So the third horseman that doesn't work well in a fight is defensiveness. And defensiveness is, you know, one of the most common of the horsemen. When we feel attacked, either by criticism or contempt, our natural instinctive response is going to be defensiveness, where we either counterattack by saying something, "Oh, yeah, well, you didn't pay the bills on time," or whining, "I did too do the dishes," you know, that kind of thing. That's defensiveness. And the fourth one we call stonewalling. That's when one partner completely shuts down in the middle of a conversation and stops giving the other person any sign that they've heard what that person is saying. They don't nod their heads. They don't say little things like, oh, I see. None of that. What we discovered about stonewalling is that many people who shut down like this are actually in fight or flight. That's where the physiological measures that John just mentioned come in. They're in fight or flight while sitting there because they're feeling so attacked. Their heart rates will be over 100 beats a minute, sometimes as high as 180 beats a minute. The only thing to do there is to take a break of a specific kind.
Talking to Julie Schwartz Gottman and John Gottman. Their new book is called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. They're sharing decades of their work as clinical psychologists and relationship therapists. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe an experience to share. That's 800-642-1234. We were just talking, John, about the four horsemen there. Now, here's a rule that could point us maybe in a more positive direction. The 5-to-1 rule, which I'd heard of, but I didn't know exactly how it worked. What is the 5-to-1 rule?
Well, it's become real famous in Seattle. I recently went to a Starbucks and a guy drove by and rolled his window down and said, hey, 5-to-1, right? And this is our magic ratio that Bob Levinson and I discovered. Is if you take all of the things somebody said during a conflict discussion and sort them into two bins, all the positive things that you can do, like nodding your head and listening and saying, interesting, good point, and being affectionate, having a shared sense of humor, take all the seconds of positivity and divide it by all the seconds where they've been defensive or hostile or counterattacking, all those negative things. The masters of relationship, the people who stay together liking each other and enjoying the marriage, those people had a ratio of 5 positive to 1 negative, which really surprised the heck out of me. I thought in a great relationship, they'd be balanced, equal, the ratio would be 1. But no, it's 5-to-1 in the masters. And in the disaster couples who either broke apart or stayed together unhappily, that ratio was 0.8-to-1, just a little bit more negativity than positivity.
And a key point, Julie, is, and you address this in the book, why we fight, what we're trying to accomplish here. The correct answer is not to win the argument. How do we flip that around and try to get something positive out of that conflict?
First of all, we really need to understand that a lot of times what we're fighting about is not necessarily obvious. It's not the issue on the surface. Many times it may be something way down deep, a hidden dream that the person has about how life should be, or a value they have, or some background history. And what can happen with conflict is that when you pause and don't move into trying to solve it right away, but instead ask each person a series of questions that we describe in the book that really deepen your understanding of your partner's position on the issue, what ends up happening is you come out of that particular discussion with a much deeper understanding of your partner's position on the issue and perhaps more compassion for them as well. After that, you can move into compromise in a much more gentle way because you have much greater understanding of what's really important to your partner, and you've had a chance to say the same in the midst of this discussion.
We're talking with clinical psychologist Julie Schwartz Gottman and John Gottman about their new book. It's called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had that one issue that keeps coming up, a point of contention in a relationship? How did you navigate it? Did you dodge around it and ignore it? Or did you take it head on? Did it go well? Do you have questions for our guest about how to make conflict something productive in a relationship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with psychologists and relationship researchers Julie Schwartz-Gottman and John Gottman. Their new book is called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. You can join in with advice of your own to share an experience or questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. DJ is with us in Stevens Point. DJ, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had the first date with my spouse 40 years ago this weekend.
Wow.
Right. For Valentine's Day. The best advice that I received before we got married was always put the other person's point of view and the other person first. And that was pretty good advice. I know that we have had less than a handful of screaming or, you know, yelling at each other fights in the 36 years we've been married. But it doesn't mean we don't still have conflict. When we get angry, we will talk. If I am about to say something that I know that I will regret and she will be angry about, I just hold my tongue if I can, and if I can't do that, I walk away for a while. When we see each other later, I think for both of us, the thing that happens ultimately, there will be, you reach out, hold a hand, something, whether it's that night next to each other once we've gone to bed without talking for a few hours or whatever, but just that contact, a little bit of a warm touch and not screaming at the other person.
DJ, thanks a lot for that call. I'm hearing DJ tick off some of the things I remember reading in the book. And Julie, I'll start by throwing this to you. You've mentioned sometimes maybe you do need to take that break. You offer some very specific stuff about how to step away, how long to step away. Share advice when somebody's in that position DJ was talking about, like, I don't want to say something that's going to do more damage. Need to take a little time here.
Wonderful question, Rob. So, yes, when somebody really feels flooded with emotion, when their heart rates perhaps are racing, when they really feel attacked, then it's time to take a break. So a specific break looks like this. First, a person says, I need a break, and they also say what time they'll come back to continue the conversation so that the other person doesn't feel abandoned or rejected. Very important to give that time when they'll come back. The amount of time a break should last is typically 20 to 30 minutes. The longest a break should last is 24 hours. It never should be longer than that. Otherwise, it feels like punishment. Then when you go into separate spaces where you can't hear each other, you can't see each other, it really is a break from the conversation, don't think about the fight. Because if you do, you'll keep feeling stress. Your body will keep pumping adrenaline and cortisol into your bloodstream, and your body will not have a chance to calm down. So do something self-soothing, like reading a book or a magazine, listening to music, yoga, meditation, any of those things that takes your mind off the fight and helps you to calm down. We call that self-soothing. Finally, go back to your partner at the time you agreed to, and hopefully you can continue the conversation at that point with a much calmer body and brain. And your brain, incidentally, will work much, much better than it does in fight or flight, to where you can creatively problem solve and listen and understand well.
Thanks again for that call, DJ. We'll go to Julie now in Milwaukee. Julie, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Hi. Well, thank you. I guess the problem my partner and I have, we're not married, but we've been together almost 7 years. I admittedly do have ADHD. I don't use it as an excuse. I really, truly don't. But what happens is I go to his house and he immediately starts picking on me. And a lot of times it's sort of like that hostile humor, but then it doesn't become at all hostile humor. It becomes just hostile. And I'm afraid to even begin to talk because he'll use it against me somehow. And the thing is, I do get emotionally reactive because he does start arguing and then he screams. He screams at me and I'll tell him, please don't scream at me. It doesn't help. And if you continue, I'll leave. I've only been able to actually leave on maybe one or two occasions because he doesn't, because then he said, well, you're just avoiding it. But I think I need to set boundaries about not letting him scream at me, not putting me down, telling me that my friends don't like the characteristics that they actually do like in me, which is, you know, my energy, my, you know, my outgoingness, my wanting to have fun, because those are things he dislikes the most.
Julie, thanks for the call. This sounds bad to me, John, and we can't necessarily counsel people on a quick phone call. Do you have thoughts, somebody in this situation, this sounds more like more than an easy to resolve conflict or even a conflict maybe even worth resolving. I don't know, your thoughts.
Yeah, it sounds like Julie's living under the situation we would call verbal abuse. And that is a very dangerous kind of situation. It really does destroy people's self-confidence. It makes them feel unloved. It makes them feel really anxious. And it's a bad climate for any relationship. So it'd be really important for Julie to set boundaries, but also to reflect back what it is that this guy makes her feel. And to say, you know, if you have an issue to talk to me about, use a much more gentle approach where you talk about yourself and what you feel. Don't talk about me. Talk about you and tell me what you need. And I'd be happy to meet your needs if I understand what they are. But when you describe me and you describe me in such hostile, negative terms, it really makes me want to leave the relationship. And I would make that a condition for staying, that he stop being verbally abusive.
Julie, thanks for calling in. I feel like you probably deserve better. In our last couple minutes, Julie, for people who have what feels like an intractable disagreement of whether to have kids, whether to move to that new city or something like that, but they know they like each other and want to stay together, how can they manage an issue like that? Very common, you write in the book.
Yeah, you know, so issues like having kids, can really break up a relationship if each person feels adamant about their position. One person really wants to have kids, the other person really doesn't want to have kids. There you have a situation where, you know, you can't have compromise. You can't have half a kid, right? So that's not going to work. In terms of geography is sometimes a little bit more solvable. But it really depends on the flexibility of each person. Let me give you an example. We had a couple in a workshop who were retiring, and one person wanted to sail around the world. The other person wanted to go live on the farm that had been in their family for over a century, and that farm was located in Iowa. So how do you sail around the world from Iowa? You can't do it, right? So through a beautiful conversation, they decided on a compromise where they would sail for 1 year, get as far as they could, and then put the boat up on a dry dock and come back go to Iowa, live on the farm for a year, and after 2 years, make a decision about what to do next.
Excellent.
So there are still possibilities for geography.
Thanks to our guests today, Julie Schwartz-Gottman and John Gottman, clinical psychologists, relationship researchers. Their new book is called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a historian and longtime Milwaukee tour guide gives us a sneak peek at his new book, which takes readers on a self-guided journey through the city. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a unique museum in the Milwaukee area.
Cats are special companions to many people, including Sean and Hillary Redner. The couple love cats so much, they created Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum, where they display thousands of cat-related figurines from around the world. WPR producer and cat lover Trina LaSousa ventured to Menominee Falls to check out the collection.
That is cool.
Yeah, that's Alice in Wonderland.
That's what I thought.
This one Cheshire is Alice with the little rabbit. Pretty neat. Now we're going to have to make room in Jan's cabinet.
That's Hillary and Sean Redner opening a package of cat-themed teapots sent to them from Hollywood, California. Getting packages like this happens regularly since they transformed their Menominee Falls home into Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. They started this as a personal collection back in 2018. Then after some media attention, Sean says fans started sending their own cat-themed items from all around the world.
This was the first collection that showed up. Cheryl Peters contacted us and sent me the phone number, and we got on the phone, and she's like, I'm old, my kids don't want my stuff, I've been collecting this since the 70s, will you take care of it for me? I was like, well, sure. She goes, no, I need you to take care of it for me. And she started to get like forceful. I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, I had no idea what was coming. So everything in this cabinet but those two jewelry boxes has come from Lauai, Hawaii.
Inside the museum are thousands of cat statues, cookie jars, plates, pieces of artwork, nearly every cat-related decoration you could dream of. Sean says most of the cat museum's items are either bought from secondhand thrift stores or shared by fellow cat enthusiasts. They hope to someday beat the Guinness Book of World Records for the most unique cat-related items, which currently stands at 21,000 cats.
It's unbelievable the amount of cat stuff that is out there, you know, and it's we're not even close to finding it all.
The museum is also home to 9 friendly rescued cats. And believe it or not, the cats have not damaged any of the items. Sean says all of the pieces are protected in cabinets or secured to the walls.
Knock on wood, they're really actually pretty good. We get that question a lot. But as you can see, almost everything is locked up. We have one cat, Batgirl, who's probably hiding in the house. It's been going up and like being curious, but I'm hoping it's too crowded.
Donated collections have the original owner's name and location alongside the display. Some of the donations even come with letters. Here, Hillary reads a note from Heather Sweeten of Illinois, who donated nearly 100 cat thimbles.
To the folks of Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum, I am thrilled that my cat thimble collection will have a wonderful new home in your museum, on display for others to see.
Sean says the cat collecting started back in 2018 at a St. Vincent de Paul store in West Dallas. He rescued a framed photo of a cat named Taffy.
It says right on the back she lived from 1960 to 1970. The picture was taken in October of 1967. So I put it back, and I'm like, this is weird. And then I was like, wait a minute. There was Vietnam and the moon landing and what was happening in this house while this cat was bouncing around. Like, I'm bringing that home. And now in our museum, we have a whole wall of other people's cats.
Sean and Hillary started Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum to help support cats. They donate 100% of visitor donations to feline rescues in Wisconsin. To date, about $3,000 has been raised.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new?
WPR's Trina LaSousa brought us that story on Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, have you ever been walking or driving through a city and wondered, why is that building there? Who put a park right in the middle of downtown? What used to be here before these new businesses moved in? If that city happens to be Milwaukee, chances are historian John Gerda knows the answer to that question. He's been a tour guide since 1975 and has written nearly two dozen books about Milwaukee, which is his hometown. His latest book brings the tour to you with an easy to follow route through the city and lively explanations of the history behind the buildings, neighborhoods, and communities that make up Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite place to visit in Milwaukee? Or if you live in Milwaukee, a favorite walk to go on, maybe when you have that out-of-town visitor? Do you like to understand communities based on a walking around or maybe a bus tour and learning some of the history behind the place you're visiting? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Gerda is a writer and historian based in Milwaukee. He's the author of 23 books. Most recently, John Gerda's Milwaukee, A Self-Guided Tour. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be here. I appreciate it.
Now, you've hosted hundreds of tours of Milwaukee since 1975. What gave you the idea to put all that knowledge and experience into a guidebook?
As you get into your 70s, you realize that this stuff is in your head and it's going to die with you. So it was basically a chance to kind of download information I've gathered over the last 50 years and put it out in the public domain where people can do their DIY tours without me having to rock around in front of a bus.
And you, a city's history can be told in a book or maybe a TV documentary, and you've done lots of both of those, John. What is it that we can uniquely gain from taking that tour on a bus or driving or on a bike of that city?
I think one of the things that makes Milwaukee somewhat unusual is how compact it is, how many small worlds there are in a fairly confined space. And traffic is manageable in Milwaukee. They talk about the rush minute instead of the rush hour. And especially when you're poking around neighborhoods, you're on side streets that are pretty lightly traveled. And you can see, and this tour takes, if you were to do it front to back in one sitting, I guess, or one driving or one biking, 3.5-4 hours. And you can see a pretty generous share of Milwaukee's cultures, Milwaukee history, and Milwaukee architecture. So I think the fact that Milwaukee is so compact, so manageable, I guess another term is human scale, I think that makes Milwaukee somewhat unusual. Imagine doing a tour of Chicago in 3.5-4 hours. Obviously, it's a different scale, but certainly it's also just incredibly congested. So Milwaukee, it's a city, as I said, that rewards exploration.
Let's talk about how to use this guidebook now. Now, if you're on a bike, you can bike to the next stop, then pull over and look at the next thing. You definitely want a sidekick if we're doing this in our car, a navigator in the passenger seat.
Absolutely, yeah. Do not try this alone if you're in a car.
Talking to John Gerda about his new book, John Gerda's Milwaukee, A Self-Guided Tour. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do we gain, John, when we go through the city and, hear the history behind this neighborhood or maybe that particular building or that park over there?
What you gain in this or any other city is urban literacy, in one very simple phrase. I think so often we travel, all of us, myself included, we travel in pretty established ruts. And to get out of those is take some effort, take some intentionality. I have a friend who's now 94, and I gave him a copy of the book, and he didn't, not yet at least, he did not take the tour, but he read through it. He said, there are things I didn't know existed in Milwaukee. So I think for whether you're a visitor or someone who, like me and so many others, this is our hometown, the fact that you kind of get off your well-worn paths and see where and how other people live can only be enriching.
Let's talk about some of the history and some of your stops here. One of them, now people may have noticed, those weirdly angled bridges that have to cross the river. That's because Milwaukee was two cities that actually shot at each other for a while. Tell us about what we could see, that early history, and what we could see now.
I think they did. I'm not sure the gunpowder was involved, but they did bloody noses. And this is back in 1845 when one side, the west side, was Kilburn Town, the east side was Juneau Town, and they didn't get along especially well. Before bridges, there was no felt need, especially on Byron Kilburn's side, who was the more aggressive of Milwaukee's founders. No felt need on his part to lay out his streets to conform to Juneau's. So when bridges finally joined, they joined at an angle. And he tried to deny the east side access to the rest of the world. So that was kind of a slow motion siege is what it was. Tried to sort of starve him out. They succeeded in building one bridge across the river back in 1840, built two more downstream, and the West Siders suffered in silence for a few years. And then one warm night in 1845, and who knows what kind of fuel they were traveling under, they cut off their side of the Chestnut Street Bridge, which is now ironically Juneau Avenue, and let it float down to the river. And the East Siders wake up in the morning to find they can't get out to the west, so they cut off the west side bridges to the south. So for a while, no one could get anywhere in downtown Milwaukee. So it's kind of a comic opera episode that has come down through history as the Great Bridge War of 1845. They finally realized that they were scaring people away. So they, in the January 31st, 1846, birthday's coming up, just the end of this month, they joined forces as one city of Milwaukee, the first city in Wisconsin before Wisconsin was a state.
And you mentioned what might have fueled the angry disputes and the bridge demolition. Your tour also takes us past some key points in Milwaukee's beer history. Where we can we see some of those important buildings in the beer industry?
All three of the big ones are on the tour, starting with Miller Valley down there on the west side and kind of looping back into the city through the north side. You can see Pabst when you're on 12th and Valit, and then kind of coming up to Schlitz as well when you're coming down through Brewers Hill. So it's it hits all three of those and then runs along Commerce Street, which is now the home of Milwaukee's largest in terms of their volume, Lakefront Brewery, which is the largest craft brewery in Milwaukee. Sprecher's the pioneer, but they're making mostly soda. And Lakefront's got a great tour as well. So we have a beer-soaked history, and that certainly is evident on the tour.
Another thing that strikes me about the book is it isn't just the big buildings or the famous buildings or the industrial buildings, some pretty humble residential ones. One example, the houses that Polish immigrants in Milwaukee built a little bit at a time. Tell us about those and where we can find them.
You know, one of the stops on the tour where you kind of pull over and tell some stories. And when I was leading tours on buses or motor coaches or limousines or whatever station wagons over the years, one of the favorite stops was always on 14th Street just south of Beecher. And the heart of the South Side, a neighbor sometimes called Polonia, the old 14th Ward. And we stopped at my grandmother's house, who was the daughter of Polish immigrants. And she was one of six kids whose father died when she was, I think, what, 8 or 9 years old. And there were on her family's lot, there were five houses. Humble would be an exaggeration, would be hyperbole. These were small homes, and on her one lot, there were, in these five households, there were 27 kids. There were three baseball teams, you know, on that lot. And the main house type in that neighborhood, and the block is just covered with them, is called a Polish flat. The building inspectors call it an English basement duplex. They kind of sort of gussy it up, but most people in Milwaukee call them Polish flats. And the story was they began with a very simple, on a 30-foot wide, maybe 25-foot wide lot, began with a single-story cottage, a cedar post with no basement, and then as they could afford to, they would raise that off using heavy industrial jacks and brick or block in a second unit beneath it. And the impact was to double the housing space without having to build a whole new house on top of the original one. So it was a rather clever means of expanding living space. And also, as I point out in the tour, these were my ancestors among them. These were peasants in the old country who were not among the landed classes. And most often the basement unit, the half basement unit, would become the a place for the first son or daughter who got married to live. They also rented them out, especially to young people coming from the old country. So in the old country, they may not have been land owners. Here they buy the little lot, they're land owners. And if they have a Polish flat and rent that out, they are landlords as well. So it was kind of a psychological as well as an economic landmark. And the South Side is just full of them.
John Gerda is with us, Milwaukee-born historian, author of over 24 books about his hometown. We're talking about his latest, John Gerda's Milwaukee, a self-guided tour. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about a site in Milwaukee, maybe in your own neighborhood if you live there, or a place you've liked to visit? Do you have some historical tidbits about your community, wherever it is, that you like to share with friends, neighbors, or out-of-town visitors? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you ever done a guided tour with John Gerda in Milwaukee? You can leave a review here. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with historian John Gerda about his latest guide to Milwaukee. It's called John Gerda's Milwaukee, a self-guided tour. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to take tours of maybe your own community, or when you're traveling, do you like those guided tours of Milwaukee or any other city? What do you get out of it? Do you like learning that local history? Join in at 800-642-1234. John, people in Milwaukee might know about, I guess it's its smallest neighborhood, Pigsville. There's argument over how it's spelled, and you dug into the origins of the name. How do we have a Pigsville in Milwaukee?
It's the area just north and a little east of American Family Stadium. It's on the west side, and it's passed by tens of thousands of people every day because I-94 is on the ridge to its south. But it's the smallest neighborhood in Milwaukee, fewer than 300 households. There are 11 streets and 7 end in dead ends. So you don't get there unless you live there or you're lost or on occasion doing a tour. I did a book back in 1980 called The West End. And when I was working on it, I was determined to find out the origin of that name. And the mystery is that there were two spellings. One is P-I-G and one is P-I-G-G. And finally found a woman whose family had been among the first down there who said that when their family first moved to the valley, right along the Menominee River, there were houses on the east bank and a farm on the west bank that specialized in pigs. So the word Pigstown appears in print way back in 1894. And my theory is that someone invented a guy named George Pig, who supposedly had a stagecoach tavern on Blue Mound Road back in the mid-1800s. And I looked for him in the town of Wauwatosa. Tavern records and census records could find no one named Pig. And my theory is that someone invented him to give just a little more cachet to the neighborhood. They got tired of snickering over the years. And you'll still see two G's. It's actually the local media's is kind of their preferred spelling, which drives me a little bit nuts. But P-I-G is the historically accurate spelling.
Now, there are real people who come up on your tour as you look back in the history. Who is your favorite character in Milwaukee history to talk about?
Boy, if I had a chance to go back and have a beer with somebody, it'd probably be George Walker, who was the founder of Walker's Point. He was kind of Milwaukee's original good old boy. Kilbourne was on the west side, was kind of a grasper and a rather unpleasant character. Juneau would have been fun. French Canadian and somebody who graduated from the fur trade to become Milwaukee's first mayor and then got tired of the city and moved out and founded a little settlement called Theresa out in the Rock River in Dodge County. And you have George Walker was the by far the least successful and the most laid back of them all. He weighed 350 pounds at a time before fast food. And despite his size, was said to be the finest ice skater in Wisconsin territory when the ice was thick enough. So he was kind of the local legend I would most like to rub elbows with.
And now it isn't just the early history of Milwaukee. You talk about your tour takes us past the Black Holocaust Museum, the UW-Milwaukee campus. History keeps happening in Milwaukee as the city grows and changes.
As people say, you can never walk into the same river twice. You can never tour the same city twice, because it is by nature a dynamic human organism and constantly in the process of change. For instance, and maybe 10 years ago, the area around King Drive and North Avenue, 3rd and North, the old 3rd and North, that had no name. It was part of the Harambe neighborhood, but kind of a somewhat border area. And now that's the new Bronzeville, 21st century Bronzeville. And that has just come alive with cultural resources like the American Black Holocaust Museum, artist collectives, a whole lot more coming from galleries to restaurants. So there's just a lot of energy there. And that's, I love that about cities, you know, Milwaukee and others, you know, they are constantly in the process of becoming something else.
Now, weirdly, one of my favorite parts of your new book, John, is under the copyright, we got the words "all rights reserved," and then right below that, "but tour operators are encouraged to use this guide freely and with attribution." You're hoping your successors as tour guides in Milwaukee take this and run with it.
I certainly hope so. I haven't taken many other tours, but I've certainly read other walking tours and driving tours as well. And there is, I'm sorry to say, a lot of misinformation out there. And I've had the advantage of doing this for the last 50 years. So I would hope that this is a somewhat authoritative guide, and I hope it gets well used, you know, certainly by other tour operators as well. All those ships coming in from Germany and the East Coast, you know, hope this is picked up by some of those visitors.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's John Gerda, writer and historian based in Milwaukee. He's with us to talk about his latest book. It's called John Gerda's Milwaukee, a self-guided tour. It offers a 25-mile tour of the city with maps, directions, and historical captions designed to help readers see Milwaukee in a new way, designed for people riding around on their bike or for someone in a car with a navigator, because it's a book. You don't want to look at that as you are driving around. Still time for you to share your favorite sites to see in Milwaukee. You can email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.